This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Jane Friedman. She's an independent consultant and also a teacher teaching at the University of Virginia and working with authors. Usually, it seems to me, mostly beginning authors, but not always. Is that right, Jane?
It's a real mix of people, both on the traditional side and self-publishing side.
And we do want to mention that there are, I mean, I'm sure this is obvious to a lot of people, but there are two Jane Friedmans in the publishing business. One is the founder of Open Road Media, and that's not you.
Endless confusion.
I am sure. And she is, you could not be two more different people. But the names being the same, I'm sure that that has been interesting to say the least.
It has, and even Google is confused.
I noticed that because when I Googled you today, I Googled Jane Friedman. It could be you, it could be her. One would not know. There's a description of her with a picture of you.
Precisely.
Yeah, it's great. So that's a good thing. I think the confusion of names online, I cannot imagine what happens to consultants whose names are things like Jane Smith or Joe Jones. I think that must be really hard for them.
Yeah. I enjoy the confusion. There's always something delightful in it.
Oh, yeah. I think I can imagine that. I think that's fun. Well, so how long have you been doing what you're doing now? I mean, is your background, I know your background, I think, is as a writer, but what led you to the having this role of developing this role for yourself as doing this kind of hands-on consulting with writers?
Well, I think a lot of it goes back to my time at F&W Media, where I worked in the Writer's Digest division for so many years. And parallel to that, I was also getting my advanced degree and thinking about how I wanted to teach on the side. So I've always had an interest in education and being in the classroom, both in traditional classrooms and in online classrooms. So, you know, eventually when I left corporate publishing and started teaching full time, I still wanted to have a hand in publishing. And so I did some, you know, publishing type projects. I ended up going back to publishing for a couple years, and now I'm trying to get the best of both worlds. So I'm still teaching. I'm writing and publishing things of my own, and then I'm helping people make their own way, find their own solution for their careers. So it's been a little bit of maybe an unexpected path for those who've been following me for a while, but I think that ultimately, an independent entity is where I need to be.
Well, you've developed a lot. I mean, I've noticed, you know, quite a few of your blogs and pieces that you've curated, I thought were really good. And that's kind of what prompted me to contact you, to talk to you, just because I noticed that you've been really smart. And, you know, I think you have a really clear understanding of what it means to be a writer today, you know, as the world has evolved into an environment for writers and other creators, for that matter. I don't think it's different for all that different for other kinds of creative endeavors. Mm-hmm. You know, landscape is different, and the way that one creates and then shares the work has really changed over the last, I would say, you know, certainly over the last 10 years, but really on a continuum maybe of the last 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's so much more opportunity and freedom to go directly to the people who might be interested in your work. And when I started in the industry in the mid-90s, that just wasn't realistic or possible for most writers or creative people.
Right. And that's both a benefit and also a challenge. I think that a lot of, you know, I talk to a lot of writers, I'm sure you do too, and there's this constant feeling welling up for many writers that they're not entirely comfortable with the new way of interacting with audiences, and yet many are. You know, you can't say all writers are any one way in their thinking or feeling about how this is happening. There's a complete continuum of of responses, and some some embrace, some are reluctant but embrace, others are reluctant and don't embrace. Others, I would say, are just saying, I don't want any part of it. I think that wonderful piece by the Italian writer Ferrante, I can't remember her, I just blanked on her first name, but she has a wonderful piece or a story about her with her first novel when she turned it into the publisher and said, basically, this is yours now. I have nothing else to do. You know, that, and most writers know that if they do that, the risk is quite large that
nothing. And you, there's a lot of privilege and being able to say that, what she said and what some other authors say, whether that's like Jonathan Franzen or someone else who, by whatever reason, whether through sheer force of will, talent, connections, another type of living through a family member or estate. You know, it's a luxury to be able to say that I'm not going to market and promote, that I'm not going to put myself out there, I'm not going to interact with readers, I'm going to basically remain in my cabin in the woods and write.
That's true.
And I think very few writers see that and they like cheer often because they're like, they want to see kind of pushing against this trend. I hesitate to call it a trend, but the predominant mode of get yourself out there, make yourself visible, get exposure. Which has maybe been oversold to some extent. But, you know, when writers see someone pushing against that and actively saying, no, I'm not going to do that, sometimes I think I guess this is where you're going to get me, you know, you have reached a hot button issue here because the luxury in being able to do that, not everyone has.
No, that's true. But it's also, I think that there are two things about that. One is it is more true of certain kinds of writing that the writer and the writing itself knows that its potential for commercial success is very small inherently. It's the nature of the literary work, let's say, or, you know, certainly poetry, where most of the work isn't going to have relatively small audiences. So the luxury there in a certain way is that you are freed from having to be concerned about how many readers you have, that your commitment is strictly to the work and to the engagement with the text. And then, and yes, I mean, it's true that it's very possible that there's a luxury, there's a privilege that goes with that. Although the second part of what I'd say about that is, you know, the statistics are fairly clear that most writers for most of our modern history have not made a living from their work. You know, the numbers today, probably fewer than 5%. And I know that the number in 1979, which is almost 50 years ago, was the same. You know, 5% of self-identified writers were able to make their livings as writers, and the rest had to do other things and, you know, could work, maybe teach. But the writing, the ability to be a full-time writer has always been, I think, something that the relatively few will achieve because there are so few books in any circumstance that will generate enough income to do that. Now, the change that we've seen, which probably we should talk about, and because we're both involved in it, is that when writers are able now to control more readily the tools of publishing and distribution and not go through publishers, traditional publishers, that the revenue numbers change. And so you may see now more individual writers who have bigger opportunities to become full-time writers because they are able to control the means of production.
Right. And I totally agree with you that it's never been easy for writers to make a full-time living. As you say, when you go back in history, there's always been the day job. And the people who've been quite successful have usually been quite entrepreneurial in some regard. So the entrepreneurship that you saw in authors, you know, I'll use the stereotypical cliche example of Dickens doing his serials. You know, everyone loves that example.
Yep.
You know, there was a lot of savvy that went into that. Or like when Mark Twain had his book sold door to door by peddlers, which was very unfashionable at the time. And, you know, the more literary people looked at him, you know, kind of a, with the, like, why would you degrade yourself in that way? You know, the only proper place to sell a book is in a bookshop. So I think that you see actually some similar things going on today with self-publishing, where the authors who are quite entrepreneurial and doing, you know, price promotions and discounts and trying to game the system in Amazon and all sorts of other things, both good and bad, paying for reviews, for instance. You know, I don't see, you know, it's the same behavior, just with different tools of trying to advance one's presence and readership.
Oh, no, I agree completely. I think that, you know, 30 or 40 years ago, there were some writers who were then able to draw large crowds and whose books were really just mass market bestsellers. And I think that they were able to not only make a good living, but they you could actually get rich. And there are quite a few writers who have done extremely well. But I think you're right. You know, if we look backward in time, even to 100 or more years ago, we see the same thing, that for every Dickens who was successful and whom we know about today, there probably were hundreds of writers who were either successful then and whose work didn't stand the test of time, or who were completely unsuccessful then and didn't see, you know, they've just disappeared. And I used to study the bestseller lists from the early 1900s, 19-teens, and the 20s to try to see why were some of those books still around and most of them not. I always was fascinated by, you know, you have a bestseller from 1911 that no one would read today. They just wouldn't. But those people were doing really well in 1911. You know, they were probably the equivalent of people today that you're talking about who were entrepreneurial, business-minded, and understood marketing. Yeah. And I think that the challenge for so many writers, and I'll go back to this sort of, I think this is something that you talk about in some of your classes, is to try to figure out what is your comfort zone? What is good, you know, what are the things that you can do? If there are 50 tools out there, or, you know, platforms that you can use to express yourself and connect to audiences with, which one works, or which two or which five work for you that make you feel comfortable. I think that's hard for writers because, you know, it's such a different way of interacting with, it's so different from the work of that's so kind of inwardly facing when you're sitting. It's you and the computer screen or you and the typewriter, and then you have to change your mindset completely to you and the people on the other side of the computer screen. Really, I think that's hard.
Yeah, I think that authors can have a hard time too thinking strategically about how do they spread their message or story through channels that don't have to do with the core, like, cover to cover book experience. I find that they struggle in figuring out, well, what does it mean for me to be an author on Instagram or on Facebook? What do I do there? And it's some sort of cognitive switch that needs to be like flipped or even just like slowly massaged into another place so that people can understand that what they do as an author doesn't have to stop when they're writing whatever it is they're writing on a screen. Like there's something that motivates each writer to produce work. I think it's different for every person. And there are certain themes and issues that you can't stop worrying over in your mind. And I think the more that authors feel comfortable tapping into those things and expressing them in different ways, whether that's on social media or on a blog or a podcast, it doesn't really matter what the medium is, but being able to express themselves comfortably and in a way that doesn't feel like they're either, I guess people always talk about crossing that privacy line where they don't want to be too exposed, but also being, I hate using the word authentic, I think it's overused, but, you know, putting something out there that indicates something about what their work stands for.
So in that context, and without, you know, I know that some of this is stuff that you, it's the kind of core of your work, so I wouldn't expect you to give away every trick you know. But right now, do you, what kinds of media are you seeing being effective for the larger number of writers? And as you said, every writer is different, but, you know, you can sort of see maybe from where you sit, you know, what things are really more popular? Like, are writers more popular on Tumblr or Medium, or is it Goodreads, or is it, you know, what is really the thing that you find most writers happiest to do?
Well, I find that it can differ based on age and genre. So, for instance, for women's fiction, whether that's romance or more like contemporary women's fiction that's realistic and not maybe a traditional romance plotline, Facebook still remains, you know, probably the biggest opportunity and the place where they're most comfortable, and it's where their audience is usually. And also, to some extent, Twitter. I think the romance community especially is great on Twitter and Facebook both. When you get into younger audiences, though, like I'm thinking of young adult audiences, I think that Tumblr is where I've seen a lot more activity and interaction. If you've ever, and actually, funny enough, the literary fiction community has kind of an affinity for Tumblr, if you know where to look. Rachel Fershleiser, who goes to a lot of industry events and is kind of their books person, who, you know, goes out and evangelizes for use of the Tumblr platform. She's kind of like an incredible firework and proponent of literary fiction and diverse fiction. And so you can see her really trying to bring the literary community alive on that platform, and it's very interesting to observe. I think children's authors, when you get younger than young adult, I see them active in so many different ways. They have such a strange problem because they're trying to appeal to educators and parents. They're not necessarily trying to attract the children themselves. But there's one author in particular, Debbie Ohi, who does phenomenal social media outreach through Instagram in particular. But it tends to like work its way through all of the things that she does, like at her site and her blog. And if you follow her on Facebook, you see how all of the threads connect into this cohesive like universe of what she does. And so she's not necessarily reaching her like the children themselves, but she's reaching the people who are buying for the children.
And maybe the librarians in particular, I think.
Yeah, exactly. And then Pinterest is a really fascinating look at, you know, women of a certain, well, of all ages, really, not just a certain age, who have really high purchase intent. So, you know, books can do really well there. And there are very particular types of nonfiction books that can do exceptionally well there. Like I'm thinking of crafts and fashion and cooking, right, and books like that.
With Pinterest in particular, let me ask you, when you say we'll do well there, I'm just trying to figure out, I've always had this curiosity about how, I mean, I love Pinterest. I actually love the visual kind of playfulness about it and the ability to express yourself. But I'm just wondering, let's say you are an author and your book is not necessarily, you know, visual. Maybe Pinterest, the only way it would work really is if you became a curator of interesting things that were in some way related to your life and to your books. Does that make sense? It feels like what you're saying overall is to treat the social media, and I think this is really smart, I think this is what you're saying, that that treat the social media as a kind of continuation and part and parcel of your creative work.
Right, Right, exactly. And I, you know, there's a maybe a more businessy term for what I'm describing, which is content marketing. Mm-hmm. I don't think authors like that term, and they don't really grasp.
No, it actually, I think it actually turns off writers in some way because it sounds like something else than what they actually do.
Yeah.
So it may be that it's a meta thing. You know, you can describe what you're talking about as content marketing, but not to writers.
Right, exactly.
I interrupted you. So were there?
Oh, well, I think that's probably the things that come to mind first when I think about social media. I'm actually currently experimenting quite a bit with Snapchat, and this happens to me frequently. And I say this to try and comfort others who are maybe like put off by certain types of social media at first. It took me like a year to come around to Twitter, and it's taken me about 6 to 9 months to come around to Snapchat. So I often will like download these apps, or I'll start an account and I'll try it for a few days, maybe longer, and I'm just like, ugh, I don't know, I can't do this. But then I'll get curious again and I'll go back. And that's usually when I have a little bit more tolerance or gain an understanding of it in a new way. And so that happened to me just recently with Snapchat, where I'm now on the app every day for probably at least 10 minutes, which for me is a lot. And I think it's going to be a long-standing player. And I think there are going to be some authors there in the long run, not now. And I'm not suggesting people go there right now. But I think there's going to be a lot more to come there.
It'll be interesting to see if Snapchat migrates into a demographic, you know, a larger, broader demographic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Twitter did certainly go from being a kind of technorati tool to being a mainstream everyday tool for a lot of people. And I think Snapchat has done that for a lot of younger people, but we'll see what happens with with older folks. And well, I guess the one thing I was going to ask you about that it's just struck me as interesting to see how massive it's become is Wattpad. And I'm wondering, is Wattpad something that you recommend to writers? Or would you say a lot of people have said to me that they feel like Wattpad is more for the very beginning writer rather than for someone who's already established. But I think differently. I think that any writer could go on Wattpad and use it as an experimental platform for trying out new work or finding audiences for things that may or may not have anything to do with their regular day-to-day work.
Yes. I recommend Wattpad often to authors, whether they're established or beginning. And for those who are established, I try to encourage them to serialize existing work there. And then for beginning writers, especially young writers who come to me looking for advice, and teenagers who are like, I want to get published, and I try to tell them to slow down a little bit. And maybe if they're looking for a community, they want to be read, go to Wattpad first before you decide it's time to query. I think it's a fascinating site and community. And it's interesting how international it is in scope. In its readership, and how mobile driven it is. And I think that says a lot about where reading is going.
Yeah. And well, what's interesting too about Wattpad is that the amount of content that has been pumped into it is just beyond comprehension in some ways, like YouTube, that, you know, where although YouTube has massive audience, you know, you just wonder whether. Is it humanly possible for someone to read or even have a clue as to the breadth of what's on Wattpad? It's just, it's almost like a universe that you can't comprehend.
Yes. It's immense.
Yeah, it's kind of fun, but scary. Because the scary part being that, you know, we are such an expressive culture that we, you know, so many people have so much to say that we are just creating an immense amount of material.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So you do these, I'm kind of curious about your online classes. I looked on your website and I saw that you do a pretty interesting range of classes online. Mm-hmm. I admire that because I think it requires a very high degree of organizational skills in order to be able to do an online class or course. And how, mm-hmm. you know, so how long have you been doing these online courses?
Well, my history with it goes back to Writer's Digest, where I launched a webinar education program. And we already had a traditional online education arm called Writers Online Workshops, which still exists today. Very, very sizable piece of the whole business. Most people think of the magazine or their writer's market guides, but the online workshops were big and growing. I'm sure they still are. So the webinars was an offshoot. It was supposed to be, because the other courses were very long and very traditional, like I think the shortest one was 8 weeks. Some of them ran almost a full year even. The webinars were meant to be very quick, a quick shot of adrenaline on a specific topic. And so I kind of got a trial by fire on running those, and because we had staff teach them to start. And so I took the topics that were most popular at writing conferences that I had been speaking at for years. So, you know, I had my standard query talk and I had my standard proposal talk and so on. And so I turned them into webinar format presentations, which wasn't that hard to do because most of my presentations were slide-based anyway. So from there, once I left Writer's Digest and I started teaching at a university level, that just, you know, that increased my curriculum 10 or 20 fold, because now I was actively teaching online writing and digital media to kids through 16 week courses, you know, three per semester. And then once I went independent, you know, I'm still sitting on this huge library of curriculum. The drawback is that a lot of it goes out of date very quickly. You know, I taught a social media class early in this year, between January and March, and I can't reuse those same presentations now. I mean, some of them I can.
Right, but the stuff stuff changes so quickly. You have
exactly.
to. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, students don't like it when you're talking about, you know, Twitter and like if I do it now, everything's going to have a favorite rather than a heart, and that confuses people. And they're like, "Well, does it mean the same thing? Why does it not look the way it looks on my screen?" And so you have to be aware of the pace of change, and then of course, with publishing strategies and marketing strategies too, even though some things are timeless, when you're looking at how fast Amazon changes the rules of the game, you know, you could easily have a class you rerun every 8 weeks that has to be updated because they changed how they pay.
Yeah. No, in fact, I think I think that's a really compelling thought that, but of course, evidently you are changing your curriculum. So your value add is high.
Yes.
I think that's good. I think I've noticed that, you know, in talks that I've given, the same thing is true. I go back and look at something I wrote, you know, I put all that effort into it and, you know, all these beautiful slides. And 1 year later, you have to go do it all over again, you know. At least you're getting paid.
Yes.
That's a good thing to make it worthwhile. So generally, do you market these, the online courses are aimed at, it looks like mostly writers. And how do you market then as a, you know, now you're in the same position a writer is, you know, you have to, what's the advice that Jane Friedman gives Jane Friedman?
Right. Well, they're the two biggest tools I have are my website traffic and my email newsletter list. So I've got this website that gets about 150,000 visits a month, and that provides its own kind of momentum for everything that I do. So I have a lot of people coming in the door every month who see that I offer online classes, and they may sign up for that email newsletter. And then that newsletter, I've got across all my different lists, about 10,000 names. So between those two things, if I put ads on my own website or mentions of the classes on my website, and then have dedicated emails that go out to my list, it's not that hard to reach you know, 20 or 30 people who are willing to enroll at the rates that I charge.
Right. No, that seems really good. I think that makes sense. So, okay. So, you know, we have to talk a little bit about the future because that's part of what this podcast series is about. I've noticed over the last 2 years that there is less interest in the future of technology and more interest in the future of marketing. And I'm curious to know if you feel that what I just described, it reflects your experience as well.
Yeah, because I think you would say the same thing that I'm about to say, but there's this focus on discoverability, which I think is a marketing question rather than a publishing question. Although I suppose one might argue that, and this happened at the publisher I was at, they're starting to think about discoverability when they acquire projects in the first place. So they're looking at search engine optimization. They're looking at like search queries and what's ranking high and using that to push book acquisitions. I don't find that the case in most companies, but maybe. I think all of the most progressive and interesting things and people and companies tends to be a marketing approach rather than say, oh, I'm going to do this really creative presentation of the story through this app. It's like no one cares about that anymore, at least as far as I can tell. People are more interested in reaching people in ways that's more effective, gathering audiences. And so those are the sorts of initiatives I see on both publishers' sides, and both on the publisher side and on the author side.
So do you think that we're going to see a continued evolution of authors migrating away from traditional publishing? Or do you think that we'll come to a new normal, you know, a stasis of there are writers who are only self-publishers, there are writers who do both, and then there are writers who publish traditionally only, and that the kind of numbers are going to stay, or the numbers in each of those categories roughly the same? Or do you think that there's still some change to come?
It's hard to see that there's going to be much more. I don't think there's going to be much more migration away from traditional publishing. I would be surprised. And that's mainly because it feels like the market is getting tapped out or exhausted on the self-publishing end. Like people are actively discussing, you know, my sales aren't what they used to be. I'm having more difficulty now than before. New authors are having a harder time breaking in.
Right.
So the other thing is, like, I don't know what the next new development from Amazon or from someone else is going to be that could change the game yet again. So there is one piece of the industry I try to look really closely at, which is how much are sales transitioning to online versus bricks and mortar? Not ebook sales, but just the total picture of print plus ebook sales. How much is Amazon, you know, basically gobbling up market share away from your Barnes and Nobles and your independent bookstores? Because I feel like their traditional publishers really excel at getting a book on every shelf where it should be in the world. And the less that that's of value to an author, the more I think you see a migration happen. But there are still, I could go back and forth all day. I think the biggest complaint from self-publishers is that, well, I shouldn't say complaint, the biggest need on the self-publisher's end is that they want administrative help. They want someone to handle back end, and so that they're not just kind of having to manage these significant marketing campaigns on their own. So I recently wrote about how there's a lot more need now for author assistants and people to help execute campaigns. And there's a huge freelance industry that it feels like has popped up to support self-publishing authors. And I sometimes wonder if publishers would simply offer some of these authors terms that were more agreeable, if there wouldn't be a migration from self-publishing back to some traditional houses. But with the current ebook royalty rates and some of the restrictive clauses that govern like your option clauses and non-compete clauses. Until those things get more flexible, it's hard to see authors going back who have already switched.
I think you make sense. Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me. This has been really fun. I think there probably are other things that we could have talked about, but maybe we'll save those for another time.
Yeah, sure.
And thanks so much for doing this, Jane. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Jane Friedman, who is janefriedman.com. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Amazing, you got it. It's great.
Thank you.
Thanks.